We're going to begin with emergency referrals and work our way through to routine referrals. Along with us on the journey, we have Dockett Stalwart, Jeff Robeson, professional advisor to the Association of Optometrists. We'll hear from Jeff throughout the programme when we need further clarification on the national guidelines and how to apply them in our case studies. So let's begin with a look at what the national guidelines are. Organisations such as the Association of Optometrists, the College of Optometrists and FODO provide frameworks demonstrating good practice for referral. We asked Dr. Susan Blakeney, Clinical Advisor to the College of Optometrists, to start us off by explaining the College of Optometrists' guidelines on referrals, and this is what she had to say.
The College produces two documents which are useful when considering referrals. Our framework for optometric referrals was first produced in 2001 and has been reviewed several times since then. It contains information on clinical decision-making in diabetes, AMD, chronic glaucoma and cataract, as well as information on the type and direction of referrals and a reminder of what should be included in a good referral. This framework document is currently being updated. In addition to this, our guidance for professional practice contains chapters on examining patients who present with flashes and floaters and examining patients who present as an emergency, and it also contains information on referrals in paragraph C142. The guidance says that if you observe a sign or symptom of injury or disease which you cannot manage within your competence or scope of practice, you should refer patients to an appropriate practitioner who is registered with a statutory regulator. If you do refer a patient, you must do so with appropriate urgency, and if there are no local protocols in place for referrals, including emergency or urgent referrals, you should follow those. If there are no local protocols in place, our guidance contains a list of which conditions are considered as emergency and which are considered urgent, and this is in paragraph C171. You should ensure that the patient understands the urgency of the referral and tell them what to do if their symptoms get worse before they are seen. When considering local protocols, there are two things that need to be in place. Firstly, you need to know how urgent that condition that you suspect the patient has is. How quickly does that patient need to be seen? And secondly, where are you going to send them? Some areas have lists of conditions that need to be seen as an emergency or as urgent, and other areas don't. If your local area does not have such a list, then I would urge you to refer to the College's Guidance for Professional Practice, which has such a list. However, all areas should have some information about where you send patients with conditions that are considered either urgent or emergency. That really should be in the consulting room, and I would urge you to familiarise yourself with that really as soon as you get into the practice. Of course, this doesn't mean you have to refer everyone, as if you do not need to refer a patient or it is impractical to do so, you may decide to manage the condition yourself. It's important to stress that if you feel a patient should be referred, but they do not wish to be, you should do several things. Firstly, you should ensure that the patient understands why the referral is necessary. Secondly, you should record a full account in the patient records. And finally, you should obtain the patient's signature on a declaration that they do not wish to consult a doctor. People often ask me what happens if they don't comply with the guidelines in practice and will they be held liable for their actions as a result? The bottom line is that if a complaint is made to the GOC or you're hauled up in front of a tribunal or fitness to practice panel, then what will happen is all the circumstances will be considered in deciding whether or not what you did was reasonable. And part of the evidence that will be considered will be the College Guidance for Professional Practice, but also any other guidance that might be there. The College produces the guidelines really to help you in your practice. They're there to reinforce your professional judgment and to give you the professional security of knowing that provided you follow them, what you're doing will be okay in that circumstance. And they're easily accessible. You can get them on the website or college members can download the app, which means that you can access them wherever you are, even if you don't have internet access, which saves you having to carry the printed book around with you. And it has a brilliant search facility if you're not sure where something is covered. So really, the best advice is to be familiar with college guidelines and comply with them whenever you can. They are there to help you. They are supposed to be your friend.
So those are the national guidelines. But as we know, applying them in practice isn't always that simple. Jeff, for the first time of many, we're going to ask for your input now in this programme. Can you describe how local protocols for referral can provide additional guidance?
Well, local protocols are quite important because there will inevitably be local variations across the country for a number of reasons, not least of which the personal preferences of the consultants who are receiving the referral. Also, possibly the availability of local enhanced services may make a difference to how patients are referred and what pathways are available. And also, we shouldn't forget secondary care issues, such as the need to manage waiting lists, particularly for high volume activities like cataract surgery. And this is something that we're all fairly familiar with. Also, because there are variations across the country, it's important to know exactly what's in place where you happen to work. And I accept that this can be confusing, particularly if you're on the border of a number of different CCG areas, for instance. And this is a particular problem for locums if you are working in a number of different practices, that requirements, the referral pathways and your obligations in relation to those may vary quite widely. The responsibility does lie with practices in some respects to assist in this situation. If they employ locums, they need to have information available to those locums about what referral pathways are in existence and what criteria the locum needs to follow. If you're not sure what referral pathways are available in your area, then contact your local optical committee for specific local advice. If you're not sure how to contact your local optical committee, then contact the LOC support unit and they should be able to assist you. Obviously, if there is a referral pathway, you should follow it, really, unless there are very compelling clinical reasons not to. If you don't follow it, it may cause unintended and unnecessary delays to the patient receiving the care that they need. Whatever you decide to do, though, your overriding principle should be to act in the patient's best interests. This may mean applying first aid measures, particularly in an emergency situation. Clearly, record keeping is important, and if you are referring a patient, you need to make sure that your record shows why you decided to refer them, and also perhaps that you considered alternatives to the referral. And this is particularly important if there is a local pathway and you have decided not to follow it for some compelling reason. If things don't go smoothly, for instance, if there is a delay in the patient being seen, you may have to defend your decisions. And as you will hear me stress later in the programme, your record keeping in these situations is all that you can rely on to support your decisions. Obviously, you will, in most cases where you're referring a patient, be communicating with other healthcare professionals, and it's important to keep copies of all of the communications.
Jeff, thank you very much indeed. Well, we're going to come back to the concept of referral pathways, referral refinement schemes, and repeat measure schemes later on, when we speak to the individuals behind some of them. But now it's time to take a look at our first case study. At the heart of the referral decision is finding the balance between being attentive and not missing an emergency, whilst not being overcautious and referring unnecessarily. There is a temptation, of course, to think that it is always better to refer and be safe, not sorry. So what happens if you get it wrong?
I went to the optician's at about 5 p.m. on a Thursday. I chose to go there because I saw some funny flashing lights in my vision, and in one of my eyes, there seemed to be a spider web. So my optician thought that I needed to go to hospital, and so she phoned the eye hospital, and they said that I couldn't go there immediately because they were closing. So I had to go in the morning. But my vision got really bad overnight. And by the time I went in the morning, the people at the hospital were really concerned that I should have actually gone in straight away.
Jeff, when is it appropriate to send a patient straight to A&E?
Well, in simple terms, when you think that there's an immediately sight-threatening or indeed life-threatening problem. So unless there is a fast-track pathway in your area for that specific condition, you have a number of options. So you're going to need to decide what's the most effective pathway that's available to you. Obviously, if it's during normal office hours, then your local eye department may still be working. If you have a hospital with an eye casualty department, that would be the ideal scenario. If it's outside office hours, then accident and emergency may be your only option. Obviously, if you're going to refer a patient as an emergency, you need to send them with some referral information. And if possible, telephone the secondary care facility ahead to let them know to expect the patient, what the nature of the problem is, and that there will be someone available to deal with them. Hopefully, you'll be able to speak to the on-call ophthalmologist. In terms of what might constitute an emergency referral, by that I mean a patient who needs to be seen within 24 hours or sooner. We always tend to think about retinal detachment, and this is probably the most obvious, particularly if it's a macular on detachment. But there are other things that might occur in the practice, other breaks in the retina and tears, a good example, acute angle closure, sight-threatening keratitis, particularly if the patient's in severe pain, possibly hyphema and hypopyon, sudden and severe ocular pain, sudden unexplained loss of vision, and some potentially life-threatening conditions, papilledema, not something where a delay to the patient is acceptable, orbital cellulitis, another fortunately relatively rare condition, but potentially life-threatening, giant cell arteritis, if the patient has maintained normal vision, and also perhaps a sudden onset diplopia, particularly if it has a traumatic origin. Other neurological problems, for instance, optic neuritis, probably don't constitute an emergency referral that needs to be seen within 24 hours. If you're in any doubt, then make contact with the on-call ophthalmologist and seek their advice. Obviously, you'll need to use your clinical judgment about what constitutes an emergency and be prepared to defend it. And if you're in any doubt, the rule of thumb is to refer the patient on the basis that it's better to be criticised for an unnecessary urgent referral than for the patient losing their sight. In terms of the record keeping, in a situation like this, you may need to make a number of phone calls, as I suggested. Remember to make a note on the patient's record with the details of the conversation every time you speak to another healthcare professional about the patient and their management. Make a note of the date and time on this entry, and in particular, note the name and position of the person that you spoke to. And this is particularly important if they've given you advice on what the patient should do. Last but not least, inform the patient's GP of what you have done.
Jeff, once again, thank you very much. To hear about local guidelines that provide further instructions for local practitioners, we travel to Norwich to find out about their Ophthalmic Emergency Referral Service, OERS. Dr. Dan Rosser, Principal Optometrist at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, has developed referral guidance for community optometrists in the area, which sets out distinct conditions for emergency referrals. We asked him about this guidance, how it was established, and how our case study would have been managed under it. This is what he had to say on the topic of flashes and floaters.
So in terms of putting together some guidance, I had a look at the guidance that was around at the time. This was sort of late 2000 or mid-2013, I would think. I looked at the college guidance that we had at the time and revised that along the lines of the opinions of the consultant surgeons and the vitreoretinal team that we had working here, just to try and find a good balance of having patients not be referred in unnecessarily, but not missing serious problems, really. So the key elements of our guidelines was, first of all, there's a list of conditions or clinical signs, really, that merit urgent referral if a community optometrist were to see these. So these in the main will be obvious. So obviously, if any retinal detachment is seen, then a patient needs to be referred immediately, or if a retinal tear is seen. We'd include in that list an operculum, so a free separated bit of retina hovering above a retinal hole. Also, if a vitreous hemorrhage is there in a patient who's reported recent onset flashes and floaters, or a pre-retinal hemorrhage, then both of those things would be strongly suggestive of a retinal break. And also, if the optometrist were to see tobacco dust or pigment cells in the anterior vitreous in the absence of any history of retinal detachment, then that would also be strongly suggestive of a retinal break. So we specified a list of clinical signs that we think just merited immediate referral. And then we also gave some information with respect to what situations we'd be happy for community optometrist to manage the patients in practice. So if the patient's symptoms were stable and not worsening, if the patient wasn't reporting the classic veil or curtain effect coming across their vision that can happen if the retina is actually detaching, if their visual acuity is normal. Again, if there's no evidence of tobacco dust in the anterior vitreous on a dilated pupil slit lamp examination. And also if there's no evidence of a retinal tear following an examination with indirect ophthalmoscopy and a 90 diopter lens or higher power. If there's no evidence of a retinal tear on that sort of examination, then if all those situations were met, then it would be reasonable for the optometrist to manage the patient in their practice. With one other key thing, which is stressed in the current college guidance, that the patient should be provided with plenty of written information on what they might notice if their situation were to worsen and what to do if they did feel that their eye was their condition was getting worse. So the case that's featured here is it's always a difficult one when somebody presents in your community practice with potentially serious symptoms right at the end of the day. As far as our guidance is concerned, if the community optometrist felt that they had the skills and knowledge to manage the patient, then they could go on and measure the patient's vision, take a thorough history and dilate the patient's pupils, possibly carry out a visual fields test, but dilate the patient's pupils and examine them thoroughly. And so we've then got guidance for them to look at, which would tell them whether it was reasonable for them to manage the patient in practice or whether it might be a good idea to refer them to us. And alongside our guidance, we've got information for the optometrist to tell them according to what day of the week and what time it is, whether they can call up our ophthalmic emergency referral service, our eye casualty, and arrange a same or next day appointment and get some advice from the specialist nursing staff on that phone line anyway. But if it's a little bit late in the day to be calling direct into eye casualty, which normally runs until about 5:30, then the optometrist can call the hospital switchboard, which is open 24 hours, and ask to speak to the on-call ophthalmologist, who can obviously give them some guidance over the phone, and if necessary, can arrange to see the patient in the eye clinic at whatever time.